Hello. You're about to listen to one of our audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio/survey to complete a quick evaluation. That's webcastaudio.com/survey. Thanks for the feedback and enjoy this podcast.
So again, I'd like to welcome you to today's Microsoft Security Webcast. This is Windows Right Management Services, Components and Architecture. And it's my pleasure to introduce today's presenter. We have Tim Upton here with us. And Tim is the president of Titus. So Tim, I'm going to let you take it away.
All right. Thank you very much, Janet. I appreciate the introduction. And hello to everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy day to dig into a little bit of the nuts and bolts of Microsoft Rights Management Services, or RMS. It's a topic that I enjoy. I've been working with it for some time, and as Janet mentioned, also on the line is James Donnelly, who's been doing lots of RMS work for the past several years. We've put an agenda together for you guys here, which is basically, you know, about a half dozen topics that we cover in the next 45 minutes to an hour. I want to tell you how RMS works. So this is a probably 200-level session. We did one about 2 weeks ago, a 100-level session overview of RMS. This is digging in a little deeper on the nuts and bolts. So not necessarily demos today, but this is what's happening underneath the cover so that you understand what's working, where the moving parts are, so that you can help you better design your RMS infrastructure and understand perhaps how to troubleshoot it if you're deploying already. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on how RMS works. So what are the communications between clients and servers in different, you know, Active Directory, SQL, et cetera. And then I'll go through different components that make up an infrastructure. So what you need from a database perspective and RMS server, et cetera. And also talk about what happens to a document when it's encrypted and protected with Microsoft RMS. So we'll talk about things called licenses. This is not like a license you pay to a software vendor. This is the term that we use when you consume or you protect content. So we have publishing licenses. We have use licenses. Are the concepts that we'll walk through there and what they do and how they fit into the big picture, what's in each one, and why they're important. Then I can talk a little bit about topology. So, you know, what does an RMS server look like? How many RMS servers do you need? There's the notion of subordinate clusters, if you will, and, you know, why you might use those, why you might not want to use those. And then finally, look at the different RMS infrastructure components and the client components. So hopefully that's the right content that you guys were looking for today. And like I said, there's also the opportunity to ask questions as we go along. First, just to give you a little background on who I am and who we are. We are a company that's 13 years old. I founded the company in the early 90s and as a boutique specialist company doing initially infrastructure and exchange, that kind of stuff, and then got into PKI or public key infrastructure and evolved that from the late 90s to today. We still do some PKI, and also we do some MIS and other identity management type services. But in particular, we got interested in rights management because it gave us and leveraged our background in security and encryption and certificates and all of that kind of specialized stuff. And RMS goes to the next layer. Not only is it both protecting and the privacy of information, but also it manages what you can do with the content after the fact. So that was kind of very interesting. So we developed a practice around it. We developed a course, which Microsoft bought from us, which is now a mock official course. And we've done a lot of pilots, a lot of training, architecture design sessions. We do a lot of quick start to get people running and rolling with RMS in quickly without getting into trouble or falling into a few of the pitfalls from the technology. We've also have a software company that we've spun out called Titus Labs, and their focus is on protective marking and policy enforcement. And there's a play here from a rights management perspective that our front end or user interface is a toolbar that allows users to mark email and documents with a with visual markings, so secret, top secret, confidential, what have you, and optionally also automatically apply rights management. So the user doesn't have to understand when and how to apply rights management. This interface allows them to classify it and then rights management, and the right rights are applied automatically, transparent to the end user. So we see that as a successful tool for many rights management deployments as well. So just to give you the big picture on how RMS works. So four big points. First is the users enroll in the RMS infrastructure. And this is actually not a hard thing. It's actually very simple and automatic and transparent to the end users. Unlike if you're familiar with PKI, sometimes that can be a little bit onerous or cumbersome. The RMS is completely integrated. Then once users are enrolled, then they just have to type up their documents or their emails normally, and they distribute their content as they would normally. And they just have to specify what rights they want for the recipient, if they want it to be do not forward or read only, or whether you want to allow to print, etc. Then at the other end, the recipient who's going to consume the content needs to acquire a license, a use license, before they can actually decrypt the content and then view it or print it or whatever rights they may have. And those policies themselves are actually enforced by the applications. So the applications, be it Word, Excel, PowerPoint, what have you, need to be able to understand the rights and present it to the end user so that they can view it or print a document. So this slide, just from a graphical perspective, one like to show Alice and Bob, our famous crypto couple, Alice having blonde hair now and apparently curlers. She's the content creator in the scenario, and Bob is going to be the recipient or the content consumer. So first of all, the first couple of steps here will occur the first time when Alice has never been enrolled in RMS at all before. So she goes to protect something, and she just clicks on the toolbar, the permissions button. And what that will do is it will launch the RMS client, which has no interface, but will just connect to the RMS server. And it's going to basically enroll Alice. And the way it's going to do that is it's going to obtain what's called a RAC. And it will Alice will transparently authenticate to the RMS server running on an IIS server, web server. And then the RMS server will then go and look up in Active Directory for Alice's account and get her email address from there. And then it will actually also check in the SQL database to see if she has already enrolled before, and if she hasn't, then she's a new user, and then it will generate her identity or her certificate for rights management, and then it will then fire that down to Alice. So this is how she just gets enrolled, and this is a one-time event, and the certificates are good for a year by default, and then once a year, this will happen again. Again, this is all completely transparent. So once she's actually enrolled, then she can actually, set the rights on the document or the email that she's sending, and then she just sends it off as she normally would. Now the recipient, again, if this is an email, they'll receive it and it'll look like a regular email or a document. If Bob pulls this off a file share as a Word document, then they just double click on it and go to consume it. But in an RMS scenario, then this needs to be decrypted, and Bob can't decrypt this without the right keys. So he's going to need to get those, and what he does is he's going to actually connect up to the RMS server, and where the RMS server is actually embedded right into the protected document itself in what's called the publishing license. And so I'm going to walk through all of these different components in more detail through the rest of the presentation. So he'll connect up to the RMS server, present the publishing license, and then it could possibly issue what's called the use license back immediately, or in some cases we'll have to go and check Active Directory and to see if this is protected for a group of users. We'll want to expand that group and see if Bob is a member of the group. For example, if it's protected for lawyers only or all lawyers, there might be a distribution list called lawyers@abc.com, and then we'll have to look in Active Directory, expand that group, and then either grant or not grant Bob the use license. And there may be a connection to SQL, depending if there's any information that's been cached. And then at that point, the server in action 10 here, the recipient Bob will be issued this use license, which has the key that needs to actually decrypt the message and view it. And at that point, he can open it if he's been authorized. So that's the whole picture all together in one. So I'm going to spend the next 15 or so slides kind of talking about these different steps and what's involved. As you've heard me mention things like use license, publishing license, RAC or rights account certificate. So I'll just take you through those components so you know the details of each one of those. Hopefully that's the stuff that you guys were looking for. So the components that are going to make up this infrastructure is first and foremost the RMS server. It's the thing that's going to certify the trusted identities or the end users, and it's also the thing that will license the RMS protected information, so it'll grant a use license to end users who are trying to open something. There's also a client component, and so this is client bits installed on a desktop. And the RMS client is about 3 megabytes, so it's very small. There's no user interface to it. It's really a couple of DLLs that get pushed out to the desktop by whatever mechanism you can. You can have them built into your base desktop or to your corporate image, or they can be pushed through SMS or using group policy. And there, the other major component is RMS-enabled applications. So these applications, so Word, for example, needs to have the ability to specify what rights the recipient's going to have. So if I'm typing up a contract, I can say, you know, that that Sally and Jim are going to have view access to this, and then maybe a group called lawyers is going to have read and edit access. And you specify that within Word, and that's built into Word 2003 or Office 2003 and Office 2007 within the core applications, which is Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and Outlook. And these applications are also the ones that are going to enforce the rights. So they need to be RMS aware, and that's why you need to be using these newer versions of Office in order to work with rights management. If you are running older versions, so Office XP or Office 2000, there's a plugin to Internet Explorer that will allow you to consume content even if you don't have the newer versions of Office. And for those of you who are a little more creative and into software development, there are SDKs where you can create your own applications or RMS enabled your own corporate applications to understand rights management or RMS formats. So a little more detail, and I won't go through all of the boxes here. I think that the notion is that there are these things that we call them certificates and licenses, that every component within the RMS infrastructure gets has to be trusted or certified to some level. So the computer itself needs to have a computer certificate, which is where we start our trust. Then next down from that is a rights account certificate, also known as a RAC. And this is what, you know, Alice got when she first tried to protect something, connect to the RMS server, and the server authenticated her and issued her a RAC. And so she will use this RAC to identify herself whenever she goes to consume something. Next is a CLC, or Client Licensor Certificate, and that is what allows users to protect content offline. So once Alice is enrolled, then she can protect documents when she's disconnected from the network or send out email when she's offline on an airplane, and she can still encrypt it using the keys that are stored in her CLC. Yes, more eye charts. Next is the actual certificates that are involved in the actual protecting and consuming of content. So whereas on the previous slide we talked about, you know, machine certificates, end user certificates, and CLC, client license certificate, those are certificates that are issued to machines and to end users, you know, for a year. And you tend to keep those, and if, you know, your laptop gets has a hard disk failure, you'll get those same keys and certificates back. For the actual content, then there's going to be different use licenses or publishing licenses for each document that's protected, and in some cases for each user that opens the document. So that's what these two items are. The publishing license is going to be issued by the user for the server that they're tied to, and it specifies the rights for all of the users. So we will tie one publishing license to a document, and it'll specify all users and what they can do. And within here, you know, you can see the different keys that are used there, and I have another slide on the specific keys as well and their strength, et cetera. And the other half of the story is when you consume content, you have this use license, and the use license will specify the rights for an individual user. And again, I'll have another slide for each one of these to zoom in on them in detail. Note on key types and key lengths for those of you who are interested in cryptography, and those of you who aren't. RMS servers have, I think the big picture here is that we're using strong keys. If you're familiar with any PKI terminology, 2048-bit RSA keys is somewhat industry standard for server-based keys. Your computers and your end users all get standard 1024-bit RSA keys. And then when you encrypt the content, it's symmetric keys, and these are 128-bit, and the algorithm we use is AES, which is the Advanced Encryption Standard, and that is an industry standard. Point is, all industry standard cryptography, nothing new and fancy here. This has been around for 20 or 30 years. What's different is some of the formats, in the sense that if you have done other PKI stuff, you may have an X509 identity or certificate, and the certificates we talk about here for end users are not X509 format from a typical PKI, but they're XRML format. So they're XML format, the little R in there stands for rights. And the reasoning behind this is that X509 standard is really about an identity and who you are, but it doesn't specify what you can do with the content. So there's no notion of print or forward or reply all in an X509 in the X509 world. So XRML is a standard that we use for certificates so we can have a rich environment to mark up rights and what rights people have to content. So what happens to a document when it actually gets protected with rights management? Well, you can see in this slide at the bottom half is really the content that has been there before. So this could be a Word document, Excel, PowerPoint, or an email. Doesn't really matter. But there's extra content that's going to be wedged into the document at the top of the file. So there's this notion of this publishing license, which is what the creator, when you author it, you'll create this publishing license, which includes the content key, or also known as the symmetric key, so the key to decrypt it is embedded within the document itself. And in addition to that, within the publishing license, there is the rights info, so what users get what rights. The second half of the story is on the right-hand side at the top is the use licenses, and that is when somebody goes to open a document, then they will get this use license, and it will specify the rights that they have in particular, and the content key will be there again, but in that case it's encrypted for that particular user. In the initial situation on the left-hand side, it was encrypted for the server, and only the server could get to it, so although you had it in your possession, you couldn't actually get to it in any useful way. So just to look at these different items and how they're protected, the publishing license encrypts for the server's public key, so the publishing license is in the document and only the server can decrypt it, so that's what when you try to open it, it's going to be sent to the server to be not the whole document, just the publishing license, so it can be decrypted and re-encrypted for the recipient. Same with the rights information, and then going down the left-hand side of the slide, the actual content itself is encrypted with the symmetric key. Again, that's the standard way that we do any kind of PKI type encryption. We will encrypt the bulk of the content with a symmetric key and then encrypt the symmetric key with the public key of the recipient, or in this case with the RMS server. And the use license, then you see everything gets encrypted for the end user so they can get access to what they need to. And the use licenses are stored in the document itself, or depending if they're using Outlook, they may be stored in the user's profile as well. So just diving in a little bit more, The publishing license includes the encrypted content key. So that is encrypted for the RMS server. Also, the rights for the end user is included in there. And you can see in this little graphic here, you can see the publishing license, the Bob at ABC.com gets read and print, and also the lawyers, so that's a distribution group at ABC.com, they get read only. The URL of the licensing service, so the licensing service is where the recipient needs to connect to actually open the document to get its use license. So that URL will always be embedded within the publishing license, which is, again, embedded within the document itself. And in order to make sure, you wouldn't want anybody to tamper with this or make a change or edit the publishing license and add themselves into the mix, inadvertently or intentionally, of course, so that everything is signed. And so the publishing license will be signed so that if anybody were to try to tamper with it, then when it was opened, you'd detect that it was changed, the signature would fail, and it wouldn't be trusted. So that's the good news. That's a very highly trusted environment and can be used for environments that have that requirement. And we do a lot of work with the military, and they really like this new application layer of ability to encrypt and protect, and we use that in concert with other, strong authentication and, IPsec at the network layer, but this is just another thing they can add if you have a truly high security environment requirement. So that was the publishing license. When you go to consume something, you have to get one of these things. So Bob had to get a use license. He gets the document, inside is a publishing license, and within the publishing license, he has to somehow get access to the symmetric key. And what he'll do is he'll take the publishing license, send it up to the RMS server in a transaction, and the RMS server will issue back down this use license, which is going to specify his specific permissions. So you, Bob, you get read and print. And then there is therefore one use license per user per document. It also issued by the same server or a server cluster that issued the publishing license. So that's important because you need to be able to get back to the server that it was encrypted for initially so that it can then decrypt the publishing license and the symmetric key and issue it back to the end user. And these use licenses are cached by default. So once you open a document, so that's a common question is, do I have to be online? And the answer is maybe. The first time you open a document that's been RMS protected, yes, you need to be online, and however you define online is you need to be able to connect to the RMS server so it can issue you the symmetric key that you can actually consume, so encrypted for you. And once you've done that, then you have this use license. And those use licenses are stored by default, and they're good forever by default, although through policy you can control that and say, I only want them good for a week or a month so that content can expire, or you can make users, connect back in once a week, once a month, in a very highly regulated or high assurance environment. So, but the caching of these use licenses is, again, controlled through policy. And so whether you want it on or off or on, but being refreshed on a regular basis. And also Outlook has a capability to prefetch these use licenses. So the scenario when you're away from your desk for half a day and you get 100 messages or more, like I'm sure you do, and then you sync your inbox and then unplug your laptop from the network and then hop on a plane and go somewhere, that Outlook will go and prefetch the use license so that you don't hop on the plane and find that 10 of those messages were encrypted with RMS and you can't open them. It will get the use license on your behalf in advance, so you have everything you need to open the content. So that's an excellent convenience feature. So a little bit about terminology in the RMS space. So the first term is what we call a root certification server. So the first RMS server you install is your root certification server or your root certification cluster. We use the term cluster because RMS is always or should be deployed in a cluster, meaning more than one server. This is for availability reasons. It's not a cluster as in, a failover cluster or what used to be called Wolfpack with shared disk, et cetera. But it is really what in a web terminology of cluster. So multiple RMS servers acting all able to complete the transactions equally. The root certification cluster also provides one certification, which means it issues identities or LACs to end users, and it can issue licenses to end users, so the consuming of the content. So it can serve both functions. And as we get into the licensing servers, the next option is where it is a sometimes called a subordinate cluster. And as mentioned, they are optional, but they provide licensing only. So in a typical environment, you will have a root certification cluster, and you may or may not have a licensing cluster because they will, again, do licensing only. And they're subordinate to the root, so they get enrolled by connecting it to the root, and then you're good to go. And they're used occasionally. I have another slide on this as well, but again, optional, and there's some good and the bad with deploying these licensing clusters. And as I mentioned, the term cluster itself is really a web cluster as opposed to anything else. And again, the reason for deploying more than one RMS server is that because you need to have the RMS server available to when you want to open content that's protected. If you only had a single server and it was down for whatever reason, be it hardware failure, then you could deny your users access to content. So no matter what the size of your environment, we always recommend high availability environments, so which tends to be a pair of RMS servers, and at the minimum, so if one's down, the other one's there to take the load, and then there's also a SQL server, and I'll talk about that next, but it should be reasonably available as well. So from a topology perspective, typically we will have this thing called a root certification cluster, which involves, first of all, there's a database. So a database can be a SQL server, be it 2005 or SQL 2000, with SP3 are options. And also there is you can use the MSDE, the personal style database engine, but it's really only for a test and demo with a single server, not appropriate for prime time or production use. So we tend to have connecting into the database is an RMS server or two or three, as this diagram indicates. And these are the servers that are going to certify the end users and issue the racks and also issue the use licenses for people who are consuming and opening content. And those are the core components, and I'll talk about AD in a minute as well and where it fits. But from a topology perspective, we have the option of having these things called licensing clusters. And these would be used where you need isolation. And the best example I've seen, I guess, is for a customer who was a bank, and they had very, very strict requirements where they really need to keep a group who are offshore isolated from the rest of the rest of their customers, so they wanted to have a completely separate environment but still be part of the corporate enterprise RMS infrastructure. So for them, it justified a licensing cluster. But for most of our customers, we find that it's not required. And one of our customers has 250,000 users, so 250,000, very large organization. And for them, it's a single root cluster. In their case, it's more than three servers in the cluster because it's because of the volume of transactions that they're anticipating. In that case, it's in 6 to 10 servers, some order of magnitude like that, just to give you a feel for capacity planning. But we chose not to go with any licensing clusters. They do add a layer of complexity, and so you really want to make sure that there's a good reason. Or there's very firm reasons to add a licensing cluster. And some of the complexities are that you need to add registry changes to workstations to point them to the cluster. If you don't use them, then everything else is very automatic. If you have just a root certification cluster, then everything is automatically discovered through Active Directory and through the service connection points, and makes it all very easy to deploy and easy to support and easy to manage. So worth spending a lot of time if you're thinking of going down that route. Think that through. The infrastructure components, the RMS server, you've seen what's actually installed on there is, you know, Windows Server 2003, of course, MSMQ, or Microsoft Message Queue, and this is what actually talks to the back-end SQL database. So as transactions come through, somebody opens something, everything will be logged, which is great and a great opportunity for auditing what's going on. You know, if you lose the connection to your back-end SQL server briefly or temporarily, not a big deal because these transactions will just queue up and then get pushed. And when the connection comes back up, they'll get pushed back into the SQL back-end afterwards. So, again, that adds some of the resiliency and availability to the RMS infrastructure. IIS is there, of course, because RMS is a web service. The administration and the consumption of the content is all connects on web ports or port 80 or 443 using SOAP protocols. There's the database component, which I've already mentioned, SQL 2000 and 2005, and Active Directory is the point for authentication. And then on top of that, the client software, so they're the bits that get installed on the end user's workstations. And by the way, if you're running Vista or if you're deploying RMS with a Vista environment, then you don't need to deploy any special RMS client, since Vista has all of those bits baked right into the operating system itself. And finally, of course, the applications Office being the core one that you'll be using to protect content and consume content. So the server, as I mentioned, is 2003 with IIS and ASP.NET. It is a stateless environment, meaning that when a user connects to the RMS server, it says, here's a transaction, I want to open a document. It basically says, here's the publishing license, and the server will turn around and immediately, or within usually sub-second, issue back the use license or not, depending if they're not authorized, and that transaction is done. So it's unlike in a web farm where you have a website going on and you have to maintain session and session cookies, or anything like that. This is just a throw something at it and it throws back a response. You come back a second later with another document, you can hit any one of the servers in this root cluster and it will issue back your response, either yes or no, with the right bits in there. So, and that the good news about that is, one, they're very simple to stand up, and two, from an availability or a failure perspective, if one falls apart, catches on fire, to stand up another one is very simple. Install the core arm, the operating system, the RMS server bits, join it to the cluster, and you're up and running. So you don't have to worry about backing up a lot of data on the server itself. All of the data is stored in the back-end SQL, and most organizations already have a relatively mature SQL backup policies and procedures. They are able to take care of that without a great deal of effort. And MSMQ is what's going to push those transactions into the back-end SQL server. And again, provide some resiliency to when you lose a connection, if you were to lose one to the back between the front end RMS server and the back end SQL database. So IIS is the administrative interface. So when you want to administer RMS, it will be done through a web page and very easy to use. There's not a lot of moving parts in the RMS server, so it's very different than an SMS environment or Exchange, where there's thousands of dialogues or tabs or settings and configuration, which takes a lot of care and feeding. RMS is really a set it and forget it environment. You want to check on occasion, you know, the odd event log, of course, but really there's not a lot of settings to set, and fairly easy to configure. You got to get the stuff right, like anything, but you will not likely be doing daily or even weekly administration in there. There are these things we call pipelines, URLs that are hosted on the IIS server. And so users connect to a certain URL, the certification URL, to get enrolled, to get their rights account certificate. And they also connect to a different URL, possibly on the same server and same cluster, to connect to get their use license when they're actually going to consume the content. So those are the main pipelines that users will connect to, be it during certification or licensing. From a related technologies perspective, RMS is built on the .NET framework, and so it uses ASP.NET for the server, and so the code gets installed there with and thus the requirement for IIS. I mentioned a little bit already on the technology, so it's not X509, which might be a term that you're familiar with, but the certificate formats and the licenses are in XML format, XRML specifically, so extensible rights markup language. Again, this is for the richness of the ability to associate rights, such as do not forward, do not print, do not reply all, etc., within a use license and publishing license. The protocol is SOAP, so what that means is that they are web-based, standards-based protocols, which means that the connections go on port 80 or port 443 if you are using SSL. So that's just an option when you configure it to pick one or the other. You want to pick the right one from the get-go to make it much, much simpler down the road. If you don't, then there's a little bit of pain of switching from one to the other, but it can be. Also with UDDI, so Universal Description Discovery Integration, not a very well-known protocol, but this is what's used to find different services during an enrollment. So when you enroll in an RMS server, there's an initial point where your first server needs to get enrolled and a certificate signed from a Microsoft web service, and how it finds out the IP address of that is using this protocol called UDDI. The database, as I mentioned, SQL Server is the database's choice here, and there are three actual databases that are created for RMS. First is the configuration database, which has all, the goodies in it. The configuration of the entire cluster is stored in there. Also, there's a template. So templates are where we allow administrators to configure a set of rights. So your typical template would be, company confidential as a template, and users can apply this company confidential template to any content, and they don't even need to know what the rights are that are in that. And so the administrator says, so anything company confidential is, any user would have read access, senior execs might have read, write, edit, and print capability. And so these templates are then stored within the configuration database. The users, their keys are stored there as well, so that way if they lose their laptop or their hard disk fails, when they go to enroll again, we can give them back their old keys so they can decrypt their old content, and we don't have to manage all of their key history, which is a challenge in a PKI environment, for example. And finally, the server keys may or may not be stored in the database. There's an option to store the keys either by default, they're stored there, encrypted and protected, of course, but optionally in a high-assurance environment, you may want to use a hardware device, such as there's a few companies out there that have these hardware devices to store the keys in what they call FIPS-validated 140-2 level 3 crypto containers. So that, really makes it very, very, very difficult to have somebody attack or get access to these keys. So some customers go to that link to do that, in which case the server keys would never be stored in the database. They're going to be stored in this hardware device. Think of it as a smart card for server keys. Then there is another database for directory services, and this is a cache, so that as the RMS server is doing queries against the Active Directory Global Catalog to expand groups, to see if Bob is a member of the lawyers group, then that information can be stored in SQL so that the next time if there's another request within a minute or what have you for to see if somebody else is a member of the lawyers group, the RMSR just can look at what it has in its SQL database instead of going back to Active Directory. So it's just really a thing to mitigate some of the performance against Active Directory in the global catalog if you're in a high volume environment. And that cache defaults to 12 hours, and it can be turned on and off, or it can be changed the length of time. And that's a great source of problems when you're deploying this initially or in the lab and you add somebody to a group and then it doesn't work as expected. Either they can consume or they can't consume as you would expect. It's likely because the cache is on, and sometimes if you just go home for the day and come back the next morning, all of a sudden just works for no particular reason. It's likely because some of the information was cached and now the cache has expired, so it's working as you expect. So we tend to turn that cache off in initial deployments to make sure that it's working properly, and it makes it easier that you don't have to wait 12 hours every time you want to test something. And finally, the logging database is where we'll log everything that happens. Anytime you connect to an RMS server, be it to consume content, that gets logged, and all of the, you know, who it was and what their publishing license and their RAC were, all gets logged in the logging database. And that, as you can probably well imagine, could actually grow significantly over time. So there is a little bit of maintenance. That's the one place where you might want to spend a bit of time is actually planning and watching the capacity planning on that. And you know, being able to there's in the admin toolkit, there's some tools to trim the logs so they don't get out of hand. So from an Active Directory perspective, so Active Directory is the center for authentication, of course, which is completely transparent and seamless, which is adds to the value of RMS. And there is a service connection point, which is really just an entry with an Active Directory, which tells users where to connect if when they want to find the RMS server in their enterprise. So this is just a setting that gets set. You need to be an enterprise administrator to set the setting, but you do that once and you're done. And then finally, Active Directory is the source for group membership, for resolving who's a member of what groups, etc. So we'll use that to see if you know, the example was with the, are you a member of the lawyers group? Yes or no. If yes, then we'll grant you access. If not, you won't get the right use license. So from a client perspective, you understand there's client software required unless you're running Vista because it's built in. The applications have to be enabled, so Office 2003 and above. And again, the applications are Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and Outlook in the Office 2003 suite. Within Office 2007, it's the same four applications, plus the addition of InfoPath is also integrated in there. And also worth mentioning is SharePoint 2007 has a very interesting ability to protect documents as you pull them out of SharePoint. So you can put all of your documents up in your SharePoint libraries and then have an integration with RMS so that as a user pulls or opens a document out of SharePoint, it can be RMS protected automatically with different rights. And so therefore, when they have it on their desktop, it's always encrypted, and you control what they can do with it. So maybe let them just read it and not print or save or export or cut or copy or paste or anything like that. So that is something that we see a lot of customers very interested in leveraging that capability in SharePoint 2007. And internet connectivity is not required for corporate client computers. The reason we mentioned this is that historically, in the 1.0 version of RMS, there was a requirement for clients to connect across the internet to get their machine certificates. And that was changed in RMS SP1, which was spring of 2005. So RMS shipped in November of 2003. Service Pack 1 came 18 months after that, so spring of 2005, and just recently in the past month or so was Service Pack 2, so another 18 months later. So the product has matured somewhat. And So just in case you see anything referring to requirements to connect to the internet for client computers, that's a legacy three-year-old information at this point. As you understand as well, you need to connect, it has to be on the network to consume content the first time, and depending on the caching policy of the document, you may or may not need to be online to consume it the second time or a third time. There is the ability to use the .NET Passport service as well, so if you want to protect for people outside your organization, you can protect for them as long as they have a .NET Passport, and you protect for them at their, you know, their Hotmail account, if you will. This is a one-way direction from a corporate environment. You can protect to each other back and forth if you're all in, have .NET passports. If you're a corporate environment, it's a you establish a one-way trust out to the passport environment, and then you can send protected content to them, but they cannot send stuff back to you protected. So that's an interesting opportunity as well for those who want to send content outside the enterprise, but also keep it locked down or protected, or you know, for your eyes only. So just a couple more slides, and then we'll have James can answer a few questions that have been posted as well. So the applications themselves have to understand RMS permissions, and this is so that they can enforce it. So that you know, when you open a document, if you don't have print access, the print button is turned off, and you know, if you have only read access to it, then the save and the save as and the export, all that stuff is all disabled with the application, and so this is why we say we have to have trusted applications in order to consume the RMS content. You can write your own if you'd like, or you can go to third parties that will actually develop these applications for you. One of the questions we get is, okay, so you know, if I have an app, why don't I just write a rogue application that is going to open a Word document? That's not that hard. And once I get access to the symmetric key, then you know I'm going to then be able to cut and paste. So as a source of attack. So the way that this is mitigated is this thing called an application manifest. And an application manifest is required by any application that is going to consume or touch RMS protected content. So it attests that the application is trusted and unchanged. So if you're looking for an attack vector to, you know, replace some DLLs with your own bad rogue DLLs that, you know, that will ignore the writes or what have you, then the application RMS, the client, will fail the it checks to make sure that the application manifest signature matches all the DLLs of the application it's trying to consume, and if it passes, then that application has integrity, and therefore it will allow the consumption of the RMS content. If it fails, it means there's been a tampering, and then RMS will not open the document, and you will not, and basically you won't be able to do anything that has to do with RMS. So it's a very, very tight environment, and there's other things that come into play here, things like the ability to set a time bomb for content so that it expires at a certain time, and if you think, well, I'll just roll my clock time back, well, if you do that, then RMS is going to detect that, and you will be disabled from doing any RMS content at all until you fix your clock, basically. So very, very well thought out options here. And I just mentioned this, if you want to develop your own application, the application manifest has to be signed. It has to be signed. You need to get a key from Microsoft in order to sign. It has to be signed to their trust hierarchy, and there's legal relationships that have to be established there as well. So makes it very difficult and awkward for someone to develop a bad application. From an Active Directory perspective, the number of RMS servers that you have in your forest is really depends on your performance requirements, also your policy. Generally, as I mentioned, even large customers can have one certification cluster. That's the most common. That's the simplest, and if you can do it, do it. You may want to have a certification cluster, multiple licensing clusters. I mentioned the example of the banking with their very specific international requirements. Multiple certification clusters is an option if you have multi-forest. So if you are in multi-forests, by define, you end up with multiple certification clusters. That's just the way it works. You've got to have at least one certification cluster per forest. And then you can have different combinations thereof. as well. Again, if you get into more complicated environments, then you need to do a little bit of homework on figuring out the best way to do it. And as always, planning is the best thing to do. So if you can get away with a single root cluster per active directory forest, then that's the simplest and often the best option. And again, if you have multiple forests, then that's you're going to have to go to multiple clusters, root clusters. And another point here about an RMS domain is not an active directory domain. So if you have 10 domains within your forest, by default, that would normally be an RMS domain would be forest-wide, not domain-wide. So just to summarize, we have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to tell you that what we looked at here was, you know, how RMS works, which walked through the first graphic of all of the steps, and then wanted to take you through all of the other the details of each step in there and what was going on. I brought you through the components, showed you what a protected document looked like, and then what the publishing license were, the use license, and then finally we just talked about the RMS topology, so where the servers are and how many you might need, and we can go into some more detail, not today, but there will be a deployment webinar in another a couple of weeks talking a little bit more about deployment as well. So from a next steps perspective, we have quite a few other webinars going on, and there's a link on this slide for different sessions, be it on RMS. Like I said, this is number two of three or four within the group, MIS, CLM, Certificate Lifecycle Manager, and ADFS are all within the identity management portfolio from Microsoft. For those of you who are interested for additional information, you can fill out this form, and I'll leave this up for a few minutes here. And if you have questions, some of the services that we offer at Titus are architecture and design sessions, so a couple of days on site, get you pointed in the right direction, very cost-effective way to jumpstart, also pilots and proof of concepts. If you're interested in any of those, fill out the information here, and we'll have someone give you a call. And or email, and you know what, if you have some other technical questions that we haven't been able to answer to date, we've done a fair bit in large deployments, capacity plans, etc., and we might be able to help you out if we can there. Now, I should mention this information is going to Titus and not to Microsoft, so I'm obliged to make sure you guys are aware of that.
Excellent. Tim, I was just about to hop on and let everyone know that. So while everyone's taking a moment to fill out that information and get that information over to Titus, we'll just keep it here on the slide for a moment. I want to let you know that we are going to be having a question and answer session in just a moment here. So if you have questions, go ahead. You can still submit those also. You can hit that Ask button in that lower right-hand corner. I know that we've had James Donnelly online with us throughout this presentation, and he's been answering a lot of questions for you. But nice to have that as well. And also remind you, too, if you'd like to print a PDF of these slides, you can go into that file menu in your upper navigation bar. Know that there's been lots of valuable information throughout as well that's nice to have posted. So I'll give you just a moment here. And if you have finished filling out this information for Titus, you can go ahead and just turn your seat to purple. That would let me know that you actually finished that. That would be fantastic. We'll give everybody just a moment here to fill that out. Okay, and I see a few of you have already started to turn your seats back to purple. So we'll give you just a minute more, and then we will go on to our Q&A. Excellent. So I'd like to thank you all for filling out that information for Titus. Sorry. And as I mentioned, if you have questions, go ahead, hit that Ask button in that lower right-hand corner. We're going to get to those. I want to point out that we do record these webcasts, so if you'd like to see any of our previously recorded webcasts, plus anything that's coming up, they're all posted at Microsoft.com/webcast. If you have content ideas, anything you want to see us do differently, we also love to hear from our attendees. And there is yet another URL there. I'd also like to say that today's webcast was presented using the Microsoft Office Live Meeting technology. So you can get a free 14-day trial. Just go to Microsoft.com/presentlive. Now, in addition to the information you just filled out for Titus. We do have a survey as well, and I just want to let you know that your feedback is very valuable to us. So if you could just take a moment to fill out that survey before you log out, we really would appreciate that. And you'll just hit that registered online area in your slide. You should see that survey in the slide area. Just hit the registered online. That'll take you right into it. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over. And Tim, James, I'm going to let you guys come on and answer some of these questions that we have that have been coming in.
Great. And I just want to say thanks to everyone. And now I'd like to bring James online. He's been answering your questions for those of you who've been asking all along. And hopefully this session has been helpful for you. And maybe, James, if you could take us through some of the more interesting or common questions you've been getting today, then that would maybe be helpful for everybody who didn't read them as they scrolled.
Yeah, okay, that's great. there was a few of you asking some really good questions there, and if you still have access to the questions and answers on your screen, if you want to scroll up and take a look at some of them, there's some good questions in there, but I'll cover some of them now anyway. One of the more common questions, and actually one of the first questions we got, is what about mobile devices? And the quick and simple answer is no, this isn't happening on your BlackBerry. And yes, you can get it to work on your Windows mobile device as long as it's running Windows Mobile 2003 or better. There was questions about how does this work with an outside organization? That's a question that just came in a minute ago. If I've got RMS running within my company and I want to share RMS protected information with somebody outside my company, and I don't even know if they're running Office 2003. The quick answer is yes, you can do it. The more detailed answer is it'll take some work, but it is doable. And part of the simple answer as well is there's a rights management add-on for Internet Explorer. So somebody who doesn't have Office 2003 or 2007, they can get access to the content with this rights management add-on. Fair enough. Questions that didn't come up, that typically do, and I'll cover them because I'm sure somebody out there is thinking about this kind of stuff. Like, where does PKI fit in? If you've already got Microsoft Certificate Services running, or some other PKI infrastructure, is RMS going to replace that or what? And the answer is no, it's not going to replace your PKI. You can use your PKI infrastructure and RMS side by side. RMS just kind of adds to it. So if you wanted to, you could have your users authenticate with a certificate, offer crypto card, whatever flavor you like, and use that certificate to authenticate against RMS and then get your RMS certificates and go from there. If you really wanted to, you could lock it down so that somebody would have to provide their PKI certificate every time they opened up something that was protected. That might be a little extreme, but hey, it's possible. Other questions that we typically get is, how do you automate all this? It all looks great, but actually, I think it was Tim that was asking about what happens, once you've got RMS deployed, how do you train your end users to actually use it, and when to use it, and how to use it, and all that good stuff. We do have documentation on that. We do have end user training on that. And of course, we send that out to the end users. But a better idea is to automate it. Use something like SharePoint 2007 that will automatically protect your documents as a user downloads them based on the permissions that you set on your SharePoint site. So you take the user out of it. And there's also third-party tools, including the Titus Labs products, that will automatically protect your documents based on the labels that you've assigned to your documents, which of course can be automated as well. And same idea with your email. You can label your emails and have automatic, labeling put on your emails and have it automatically rights protected based on whatever rules you want to set up. It can be on who it's going to based on Active Directory group or distribution list or what have you. I think that covers pretty much all the standard questions. Let me just take a quick second to scroll up through some of the questions we already saw, just to see if there's anything worth adding to it.
That sounds like those are the core ones.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. If anybody has any other questions they want to throw out at me, go ahead and type them in. I'll pick them up.
Well, great. Like we just mentioned, if you have any additional questions, you go ahead. You can still submit those, and we will answer those via the Q&A text window there. So feel free to still submit your questions if you do have any. I want to remind everybody, too, that your feedback is very valuable, so please do take a moment to fill out that survey before you log out. We do appreciate that. And with that, I would just like to extend a special thanks to both Tim and James for hanging out today and getting all your questions answered and everything. So thanks so much, guys, for today's presentation. And that concludes today's TechNet Live meeting. So thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Hello, thank you for listening to this webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio.com/survey to complete a quick evaluation. Thank you.